it is the Marxist contention that capitalism goes through an uncontrollable anarchic trade cycle of boom and then slump, and it cannot avoid this trade cycle. It's written about in an article in the current Socialist Standard, very interesting. And capitalism without crises is as impossible as it was for 1 + 1 = 5. Now, capitalist philosophers, who are very fond of this concept of free will, they may say that nothing is inevitable. There are no gods, they quite rightly say. There are no natural laws, they quite rightly say. And, they conclude, there are no social laws. And in this, they are wrong. Because historical materialists agree that there are no gods and there are no natural laws which say that this must happen and it is inevitable. It is fatalism. Because these forces beyond our control say they must happen. But historical materialists do say that social laws, for example, the laws of the profit system, the principles which make it a profit system, we have not got the freedom to create capitalism without crises, or to create capitalism without wars, or to create capitalism which does not give rise, even in a few people's heads, to the ideas of socialism, any more than we have got the freedom to make 1 + 1 = 5. It is freedom based upon an illusion. And this has an important practical consequence. Imagine that there are two workers. One of them is free to dream of being a millionaire, but he has no capital, and as you can only exploit other people's labour for profit if you do possess capital, he's free to think about being a millionaire, but like millions of other workers, he'll never become a millionaire, because within capitalism, the mass of the working class will die in the working class, even if the exceptional few move into the exploiting class. Then there is a second worker who is free, who is a socialist. He realises that only by cooperating with others to produce social wealth and to possess the means of creating social wealth will he or she ever be free. That, in other words, freedom lies in a particular historical course. Now, the first worker's freedom is an illusory kind of freedom. It is freedom which is based upon an ignorance of the social process. It is freedom which is based upon dreaming, upon illusion, upon thinking about something that might happen. The second worker's freedom, the socialist idea of freedom, is based upon a consciousness of necessity. It is the factor of human consciousness which prevents what is going to happen next from being inevitable. I think that I am now going on to make my next point. But if our chairman this evening nudges me in the elbow and says, "You've spoken for too long, you're not going to make your next point," he's free to do it. It's within his powers of the chairman. I hope he doesn't, but he's free to do it. But if our chairman this evening...
Don't preempt me or tempt me.
But if our chairman this evening feels that it's so warm in this room that he's not going to stop me from speaking, but he's going to transport us all to the Bahamas. Well, of course, he's free to think that. That thought can go past his free mind in precisely the same way as the thought of stopping me from speaking. But the second one is based upon an illusion. The first one is based upon an idea of what is within the potentialities, what is necessary, what can be done. And therefore, the objection that Marxists stand for some sort of inevitabilism, some sort of fatalism, that because we talk about social laws, things have got to happen. This is answered by the fact that human beings have consciousness. Not consciousness which can do anything. Not consciousness which is that kind of free will, which is no more than wishful thinking. But a consciousness which is based upon understanding what can be done, and then changing the social laws so that they do not have the results which we don't want. So that if we say that capitalism inevitably produces wars, that doesn't mean that there will inevitably be a third world war. There will only be a third world war if the factor of human consciousness does not act upon and destroy the social laws which give rise to that. And the second objection to historical materialism I want to refer to, which is really the same idealistic objection dressed up in a different wrapping, is that historical materialists do not take sufficient account of the role of individuals in history. It's claimed, for example, that historical materialists don't take account of great men, great women. They would refer to Napoleon or Hitler or Henry VIII or Elizabeth I or Margaret Thatcher. And indeed, it's true that individual actions, they have a point, individual actions do have some influence on the course of history. For example, in his History of the Russian Revolution, Leon Trotsky emphasises the contribution played by Rasputin to the intense opposition to Tsarist autocracy amongst the Russian middle class. Now, it would not be true to say that if Rasputin hadn't come along when he did, someone else would have come along in his place who would have been exactly the same. There's no evidence at all to think that. In other words, here you have an example of an individual having some effect on the course of history. Another example, in 1920, King Alexander of Greece died as a result of being bitten by a monkey. Good way for a king to die. And the resultant turmoil in Greek society was disastrous. In fact, Sir Winston Churchill commented in one of his books that 250,000 persons died of this monkey bite. So we are urged to revise our theory of factors. The mode of production, the critics say, may influence history, but great individuals do so just as much. Now, in 1898, Plekhanov published an essay entitled The Role of the Individual in History, and in it he stated that, I quote, "Owing to the specific qualities of their minds and characters, influential individuals can change the individual features of events and some of their particular consequences, but they cannot change their general trend, which is determined by other forces." So in other words, Rasputin accelerated the trend of opposition to Tsarist autocracy, but the trend itself was a product of the political needs of a modernising Russian economy. The existence of Hitler may have shaped the form of German fascism in the 1930s, but the seeds of fascism and the trends towards nationalism and totalitarianism had been present in the German state for many years before. They were only responding to a trend. Marx and Engels were certainly significant individuals in formulating a theory of history and a critique of society, but socialists do not owe those ideas only to Marx and Engels. Marx and Engels were themselves responding to a trend within history, the class struggle within capitalism, the experiences of the working class, which gave rise to this. And also, and here's where I conclude on these points, Plekhanov himself is an interesting example of the individual influence in history. Until 1884, there were no Marxists in Russia. It was Plekhanov who introduced Marxist ideas to a small group of Russian intellectuals. There were only four of them: Plekhanov, Paul Axelrod, Vera Zasulich, and another one called Leo Deutsch, who died very soon afterwards. And they formed the first ever Russian Marxist organisation, the League for the Emancipation of Labour. And in most histories of Russian political thought, Plekhanov is referred to as the father of Russian Marxism. Now, in a sense, this is true, because Plekhanov introduced Marxist ideas to Russia. He was a person who put in a great deal of the work in enabling those ideas to be set up. In 1898, he was one of the prime forces in the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, where he collaborated at first with Lenin until 1903 in spreading Marxist ideas in Russia. But of course, had Plekhanov introduced such ideas to Russia in 1584 or 1284 or 1084, then those ideas would not have been in line with a trend of thinking. They would not have been in line with the experiences people were thinking about. So in other words, when it comes to it, individuals can influence the shape of history, the form in which history works itself out, but they cannot, in fact, go against the whole trend of history. Now, what I want to conclude by saying here is that Plekhanov entered into two major battles during his life. Firstly, against the Narodniks, who argued, or the populists, and they argued that Russia doesn't need to go through a period of capitalism. Russia can escape that period, it can go around it, it can forget about it. Plekhanov argued the same causes are at work in Russia as are at work in all other European countries. by the action of enlightened individuals. And in fact, in the final lecture of this series, which deals with the ideas of Martov, a Menshevik, against the ideas of Bolshevism, I shall have more to say about that particular view of history. At this point, I've spoken for long enough.
First of all, about Plekhanov and Karl Marx. Karl Marx was obviously utterly delighted and elated to find that from the very place, the last place in Europe that he expected, which he denounced so vehemently and in my view absolutely justifiably as the black hand of the Russian secret police and every chancellery in Europe, Karl Marx, when he discovered that the German professors, and you probably have known some of them, denounced for their ridiculous ignorance and pedantry and obstinacy and dogmatism, that it was precisely in Russia that you've got a number of brilliant thinkers who even preceded in some respects Plekhanov. Plekhanov quotes with great approval, I won't read it all to you here, but we have a number of magnificent volumes. By the way, I'm sure Steve will agree with me. Don't worry about the size of this. I know you'd need a lifetime to read five volumes of Plekhanov's philosophical work. But working people can master all these things. One of the ways we can master it is by exploiting people like Steve to give talks about it. And you must learn to skim. You don't need to wade through. You don't need to with capital either. You can skim and you can concentrate on the parts that are important. Now about the subject itself. Plekhanov quotes Chernyshevsky, who was writing about the mid-century. And Chernyshevsky, a great Russian literary figure, was already sort of wrestling or already sort of gyrating around the idea of the materialist conception of history. A long passage here quoted by Plekhanov points out Chernyshevsky's description of the whole outlook and ideology, in fact, of the Russian peasantry compared to the Russian aristocracy. Their idea of beauty, their idea of efficiency, that the Russian peasant girl was buxom and strong with big hands and feet to do work and produce kids, whereas the parasites, of course, were very skinny and emaciated and drew long nails and all the rest of things that famous parasites do. Now, to prove that they've never had to do any work. What was the argument, and Steve never had time to deal with this, I'm sure he will later, the tremendous value and the colossal contribution of Plekhanov to the whole argument was what was going to happen, as Steve pointed out, to the revolution in Russia, and who would be the main actors in the drama, who would carry it out. Now, people like Chekhov and Bakunin particularly, and the whole theory of Bakunin's anarchism, they were idealising, romanticising and fantasising the Russian peasantry. He was the man who would set fire to the landlord's mansion. He was the man who in previous revolts had shown what the peasants could do. And they wanted no part with the stupid and docile German social democrats or the British workers. It was Plekhanov, I must say that I've listened to many of them, as you know, in Russia. I've listened to Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin and the others explaining the peasantry in Russia. Nowhere, and at my time of life, having lived as a boy in Russia, nowhere, until I read what Plekhanov had to say about it, was I really absolutely clear about it. May I just read a little passage very quickly? And now the time has come, because Plekhanov is explaining what actually, and what did happen with the Russian peasantry, with the Russian Revolution. And now the time has come when the peasants have ceased to belong to the masters, the so-called liberation of the peasantry, which was a con trick, of course. But on the other hand, the soil has also ceased to belong to the peasants. It has to be redeemed, to be paid for in money. Now this you could have said to Arthur Scargill on television last Thursday night. Plekhanov wrote in 1880. What is money? It is first and foremost a commodity, and a commodity which has a very special character, a commodity which buys all other commodities, a commodity which is the measure and expression of their value. Needless to say, this special commodity cannot be an exception to the general laws of commodity production and circulation. On the contrary, it's the vehicle of those laws. It extends their operation to every place where it happens to make its appearance through the hazard of some exchange transactions. But what are the laws of commodity production? Well, a brilliant writer. What is a commodity and where does it come from? Commodity production develops only in a society in which the means of production, and therefore the product, are the private property of the producer. Without this condition, no division of labour would be enough to give rise to commodity production. Hence, commodity production is the result of the development of private property. Money, which naturally grows out of commodity production, presupposes a private owner, in exactly the same way as does, generally speaking, the entire process of commodity production. Individual members of the village commune can acquire money only in exchange for things which are their private property, although they are produced by cultivating communal land. This is the famous Russian mir, incidentally the Russian word mir, which means village and also the world, which also impressed itself on the mentality of the Russian peasant. The idea of Bakunin and others was that there was collective cultivation of the land. I'm going to suggest to you and to Steve that in those few words, Plekhanov showed himself the master of explaining the whole of the problems of the development of the Russian Revolution. Incidentally, when he said, as Steve said, that capitalism, that was the argument. They were saying there's no necessity for capitalism at all. And I would say that Plekhanov's works refute Lenin's subsequent views.
I think, unless I've misunderstood, Plekhanov, sort of outlined the materialist conception of history there. And you gave us one of the examples from the setting up of slavery. And basically, I think that you suggested that the property owners, if you like, at the time, actually set it up because they thought that would be more profitable. And then you continued to say that slavery was abolished and feudalism, I think that was what you said, was introduced, because that would be more profitable. The point I make, is that a fair outline of the materialist conception of history? Because, are we then to think that capitalism will be abolished because, again,
not
profitable.
On a technical point, I think you're right. On a technical point, I wouldn't want to use the word profitable because I think it has other economic connotations, which I'll explain. But I think what you can say is it will be more socially useful. And this is how I think it happened. In the case of slavery, as I previously explained, and as Plekhanov explained, the position where the conquest of people in battles was easiest to consume the people themselves in a very direct form, of cannibalism. That was superseded only at the point where the productive forces made it more socially beneficial to keep the human beings alive as slaves because they could create wealth over and above their own value as consumable creatures. In that sense, it was a case of the relations of production, relations based upon cannibalistic exploitation, giving way to a new relation of production as a result of a contradiction between the growth of productive forces and outdated relations of production. But with the growth of production within slave society, or what Marx referred to as classical antiquity, there was a growth in the ability to produce wealth which made it more economically beneficial to the ruling class in society, to the slave owners, to give each slave their own piece of land. Instead of keeping the slaves in an area where slaves were kept and allowing them out to produce wealth, it became more economical to give each slave a small patch of land and turn him into a serf. And when he had that land, he had to work a certain amount of time on his own land to provide sufficient for himself, and the rest of the time on the landlord's land to provide for him. So it was a change in the form of parasitism in line with the economic needs of the ruling class. Now, in the case of capitalism, What's happened with capitalism is that feudalism gave rise to socialism, to capitalism. Feudalism gave rise.
It's not my whole image now.
They're all awake.
I wish it had.
That's actually what the Narodniks in Russia thought would happen. But feudalism gave rise to capitalism. And because of the economic laws of capitalism, it was first of all profitable to be able to exploit what had previously been the peasants, to throw the peasants off of the land, and to turn them into propertyless workers. In other words, to say, you don't each have your own patch of land, you have no land, you have nothing, we have no obligation to you, you're free. That's what capitalist freedom means. It means you have nothing. And because of that, you are free to be exploited at any time. Now, that worked to a certain point, and from the point of view of the capitalist class, it still does work, just as from the point of view of the feudal ruling class, their feudal system worked, but the new capitalists said, no, it doesn't. We want our system to work. We see it as being more beneficial. Now, in terms of what is the purpose of society, which is the production and distribution of wealth, in its widest form, not just bread, but art and all of the other needs of human beings, we've reached a point in capitalism where, from the point of view of the majority of people, we have a technical capability of satisfying people's social needs without exploitation. That the exploitation of the mass of humanity as workers is in fact an inhibition upon the productive capabilities of society. And that is why, in that sense, whilst I wouldn't say that socialism will be more profitable than capitalism, because in a technical sense it will be a society without what is now called profits, it will not be a society where profits will be ploughed back into society in the sense that, you know, Leninists and Stalinists have spoken about profit in Russia. It will be a society, however, where the production of wealth will take the form of satisfying, quite directly, human needs. And what we're saying in that sense, that it will be more beneficial in terms of the social purpose of society, the purpose of society, than capitalism is at the moment. That all of the problems which capitalism has as a result of contradictions in it can be overcome by the transformation of capitalism and the creation of socialism.
Yeah.
Could you outline briefly what exactly was the point of contention between Lenin and Karl Marx? I for one am not very sure.
Yeah. I'll do that now. In 1898, Lenin and Karl joined the same organisation together with Julius Martov, Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, and they formed a journal called Iskra, and that journal put forward very basic Marxist ideas. Now, I have to say this, and I have to say this with respect to what Harry Young said. Plekhanov was a Marxist, but like all Marxists, like Harry Young, like myself, no Marxist is a perfect Marxist. No one's got the absolute knowledge of the theory of society. And Plekhanov didn't either. And one of the things which Plekhanov believed, and it was absolutely understandable within the terms of Russian society, he inherited some of the old Narodnik ideas, which had been held by Chernyshevsky and the other people, which was that a small group of people could somehow dictate the course of history in some way. And this was the early view which Lenin held, and Plekhanov shared with him to a certain extent. Now, at the 1903 Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, there was a split. And the split was essentially over the principle of whether there was going to be a spontaneous growth within the working class. In other words, whether the working class experience would lead it to develop socialist ideas as a result of the motivation which capitalism gives workers to do that. Or Lenin's idea that a small group of professional revolutionaries can somehow direct the course of history. In this sense, Lenin was close to the populists or the Narodniks, because what Lenin was saying was, well, never mind about capitalism developing. He didn't, of course, say this explicitly, but this was the implication of his argument, that the development of capitalism, the development of a large working class, the development of all of the other prerequisites of socialism are less important than having a well-trained, conscious vanguard who can direct the course of history. Now, on this, Plekhanov entirely disagreed. Lenin said, the Socialist Party has to be a party which sets itself apart from the working class in the sense that it's a vanguard. It stands at the head of the working class. It's only for professional revolutionaries, for people who can give up all of their time to be in it. Lenin actually said in What Is To Be Done, workers as a whole can only develop trade union consciousness. They can't get beyond asking for higher wages to ask for the abolition of the wages system. Lenin made the point that workers are controlled by their experience of working in factories and all of the other pressures of capitalist life, and he says, how can workers possibly ever develop socialist consciousness? Plekhanov disagreed with this, and Lenin said you need a centralised, disciplined working class party. Plekhanov said, no, you need a party based upon ideas. You need a party which is going to convince people, which is going to have an educative process. And Plekhanov, in fact, wrote a pamphlet which was called Centralism or Bonapartism. And in it he said, Lenin's view of the Socialist Party is not the view of the Socialist Party which is that it has to persuade people, that it has to link up with the experiences of the working class. Lenin somehow thinks that you can impose upon history the socialist plans for the future. And in this sense, Lenin was an idealist. There's no other term for it. Lenin was an idealist in this philosophical hope that he had that you could do in Russia what simply couldn't be done. On the second point, incidentally, of Plekhanov's misunderstandings of the Marxist approach, it has to be said, and it would be a dishonest omission for me not to mention it at some point in this talk, Lenin and the Bolsheviks, for all of their errors, and I'm going to argue in a later lecture in this series on Martov and the Mensheviks, that the Bolsheviks made far more mistakes in terms of Marxist theory than the Mensheviks did. But despite that, when it came to it, it was Lenin and the Bolsheviks who opposed working class participation in the First World War. Plekhanov, to his absolute discredit as a working class thinker, supported working class participation in that war. And from that point of view, he of course discredited his entire Marxist principles. So the debate between Lenin and Plekhanov was essentially about how you see socialism developing, what the historical conditions for socialism are, what a socialist party should be. And on all of those points, I would say Plekhanov held a view which was far superior to the one held by Lenin, despite the fact that in particular tactical and strategic considerations, Lenin and the Bolsheviks were by far the more principled Marxists than Plekhanov. I don't know whether that explains it adequately. There's a book written by someone called S.H. Baron, which is called Plekhanov, the Father of Russian Marxism. And if you read that book, it gives far greater detail of this dispute between Lenin and Plekhanov. Also, incidentally, if you read volume one of E.H. Carr's History of Soviet Russia, he goes some way towards explaining what the split was about.
Yes. there are a couple of points I'd like to ask about, if I could. The first one is rather brief, simply to ask whether, in connection with the last point raised, whether Plekhanov in fact became a member of the Mensheviks after the split in 1903, was he an active member of the Menshevik group subsequently to that?
Do you want to answer that now? Okay. Yes, he was, and he edited. What happened was, after 1903, Lenin and the Bolsheviks left the much activity in the Russian Social Democratic Party, and Lenin Plekhanov remained the editor of Iskra after that period.
Okay. The other point I was going to ask about is that in your in talking about the materialist conception of history as outlined by Plekhanov, you seem to emphasise in particular the argument in relation to the productive forces and the growth of the productive forces and the way in which that leads to social change. And you didn't seem to have a lot to say about the question of class struggle specifically. Is this connected with Plekhanov's view of that? What really was Plekhanov's position in relation to the class struggle as a factor in history?
One of the things, of course, is it's impossible to talk about the Marxist theory of history without talking about class struggle, which is why in the introduction to the whole series, which I gave at the beginning, I pointed out that these whole lectures, series of lectures, are based upon the, are based in the setting of the class struggle. We're not just talking about ideas in general, we're talking about ideas in a particular antagonism in society between two class interests. Plekhanov makes an interesting point about the class struggle, which is very similar to the point which the Socialist Party would make, which is the class struggle itself is not an ideal. If you listen to many people on the British left, for example, they will say, what we need is more class struggle. What we need is a bit of class struggle here. The class struggle is going to intensify next week. Come out, comrades, and join the class struggle. It's not like that. You wake up in the morning and the class struggle is there. The class struggle is about whether you get out of bed and go to work, or it is about whether you stay in bed and somebody else goes out to work for you. That's a class struggle. And in that sense, the relations of production put us... struggle is one of those words which, is in some sense, is one of many words which has played a linguistic disservice to the socialist movement. Struggle's a funny sort of word, you know, everyone uses it. You hear it even in the Labour Party conference now, which shows that it's bloody intellectually redundant. Because people say, you know, there's going to be a struggle here and a struggle there, and the women's struggle and the men's struggle and the gay struggle and the black struggle and the white struggle. But when it comes to it, the struggle is in fact, which Marx refers to, and the struggle which we're interested to historically, is in fact simply part of the activity of human beings in their day-to-day lives. It's part of the active attempt by human beings to gain some control over nature. That's the first struggle, and that's the one which Marxists are primarily concerned with, the domination of humanity over our environment. That's what the struggle is all about. In the earliest days of humanity, human beings were almost entirely dominated by nature. In that sense, they were almost indistinguishable from other animals. In fact, we evolved in that sense from other animals. But during the course of the development of the human species, there has been an increasing adaptation of humanity to dominate nature. And of course, the idea of socialism represents, if you like, the ultimate domination of nature, the conquest in the struggle of man or humanity over nature. Now, the class struggle plays an important part, of course, in the changes that take place in society, because it's only through the class struggle that human beings gain consciousness. It's only through the class struggle that the French Revolution took place. It's only through the class struggle that strikes take place, because you wouldn't have a strike, you wouldn't have a revolution, you wouldn't have a war if there were not conflicting interests in society. But in a sense, it's important to be able to recognise that these conflicting interests go on quite separately from the will of human beings for them to go on, so that you might get the most entrenched and muddle-headed Tory in the world. He's still part of the class struggle, and he's still a worker in the class struggle, and his interests are still the same as a revolutionary socialist in that class struggle. He may support Margaret Thatcher, he may support eroding the powers of the unions, he may support shooting socialists, he can support what he likes, but at the end of the day, his objective class interest lies in the opposite activities from the ones which he supports. So from that point of view, the class struggle is something which is objectively part of the historical process and not something which is voluntarily entered into. But it is consciousness and the ability to learn from the class struggle and to win in the class struggle, which is the important Marxist concern.
I think the fashionable phrase which you hear in the Labour Party conference now is to say that there are a group of workers in struggle. They say in struggle as if it's being entered into at that moment voluntarily.
I'm not sure whether I've been to all that enough at the end of his life. What about geographical areas where we have most importance upon human societies? Can you tell me a little about it? I'm not sure if it's true or not.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yes, it's an interesting point. Plekhanov's increasing acceptance of the idea of geographical determinism. Yes. Can I say, this book, The Materialist Conception of History, wasn't a book, it was an essay, which Plekhanov published I'll just show you while I'm at it. These are the kind of, apart from the collected works there, which Harry Young's pointed to, this is a book called The Development of the Monist View of History. And these are three essays. This one's called The Materialist Conception of History, in which he deals in particular with the views of a Russian idealist called Mikhailovsky. This one is called The Role of the Individual in History, which again was an essay. And this one's called Fundamental Problems of Marxism. Well, it's not on that cover, that's what it's called, Fundamental Problems of Marxism, in which he gives a very detailed, and I would say one of fairly complicated, explanation of Marx's thesis on Feuerbach. Well, having said that, this book here, The Materialist Conception of History, was itself a book review of a book on historical materialism written by an Italian writer called Antonio Labriola. And Labriola held a view which was very close and largely in line with historical materialism. But one of the things which Plekhanov criticises in Labriola was that Labriola held the view that racial differences were one of the determining factors in human development. Now, Plekhanov pointed out just how fallacious this argument was, that in fact the vast amount of recent history, there is absolutely no importance which can be attached to racial differences between human beings, whether in the early stages of human development racial differences may have had some important determining factor is a possibility one way or the other, but certainly in most of modern history racial differences had no importance at all. But also, towards the end of his life, it's quite true, Plekhanov moved nearer and nearer to a form of what has since been called geographical determinism. In other words, he began to argue that there were differences between different nations, between different cultures, which were based upon the geographical environment in which they were living. And in this, of course, he was very close to a writer of the 19th century, late 19th century, I believe, called Buckle, who argued a very similar theory, that was the initiator of the theory of geographical determinism. Now, where many people have criticised Plekhanov on this, quite correctly, and where I would criticise him, is that he attached tremendous importance to the fact that if people live in a certain region, well, let me put it in very simple, crude terms, it's a kind of a variation of the theory that Italian people are very excitable because they live in a hot climate, and therefore, and English people or German people are very placid and cool and reserved because they live in a very reasonably temperate sort of climate, and other people have different characters. When it comes to it, of course, one of the arguments which can be put against that theory is that if you look at the history of how people settled in particular places, that the history of the settling of different populations in different nations and the adopting of different cultures by different groups of people, you'll find that historically, empirically, that argument doesn't stand up. That there are all kinds of people, for example, if you talk about the Italians being very excitable because they live in a hot climate, because if you start to talk about the Roman Empire and the kind of characteristics which were attached to the centre of the Roman Empire in Rome during that period, you would find that completely different characteristics existed, yet there was basically the same geographical environment and the same kind of motivations for the same kind of culture, but it didn't happen. And you get variations of this in recent times. One of the most striking ones is that not very long ago, even when a number of people here were living, they'll remember that there used to be a theory that Arab people were very dull and backward and unable to industrialise because they lived in deserts and it was very hot, and you know, you used to read books in schools about Arabs sleeping all day and they couldn't be bothered to get up and so on. Well, suddenly it's all changed. Suddenly it's all changed. Now that Dennis Healy and Geoffrey Howe have to go with their begging bowl to the Arabs and to the oil sheikhs, it's all changed. And of course suddenly everyone's saying, well no, it is precisely because of the geographical conditions in the Arab countries that Arabs are industrious and economically successful and so on. And when it comes to it, and when you actually come to look at the migration of individual of groups of people in society, geographical determinism has very little to be said for it. But nevertheless, there can be a debate about the extent to which Plekhanov went overboard on this theory, and I would say he did. By and large, of course, Plekhanov was like most great thinkers. Great thinkers should normally die 10 years after they become great thinkers, because you normally find the second 10 years they start to become rather less great thinkers, and the 10 years after that they become pretty bad thinkers. And this is what happened, of course, to Plekhanov. He came up with all kinds of ideas which were, he saw, as elaborations of the materialist conception of history, but which were in fact exaggerations of that theory, and in many respects unacceptable ones.
Can I ask a question about this? These examples that you have given seem to me to be more of a climatic than a geographical theory, because they have all referred to particular climates. And I haven't read Plekhanov on this before, and this is a form of question, really, or lead up to a question. There are two areas in the world where historically naval enterprise is developed in the Scandinavian region and in the Aegean in early stages. And of course, this must be because of the large indented protected coastline. And there are other areas where, because trade routes have been confined, they become nodal points and have also become a focus of important development. Could not there be some geographical determinism in that sense?
I don't want to bend the argument the other way. I think that there is. I think that the argument in favour of geographical determinism is that there are aspects of human development which are determined by geographical conditions. What I'm saying, and I think the critics of Plekhanov have said, is that to turn geography into the principal factor in social development is to stretch too far in favour of geographical determinism. And some people have seen this in the works of Plekhanov. I think they're right. I think this was becoming present in his later writings. But nevertheless, you're absolutely right. In fact, I've often argued that for historical materialists, many people who study history, and even many people in this party, have an absolutely appalling knowledge of geography. And it's absolutely true that you talk to people, and especially a certain group of so-called historical materialists who were fashionable a few years ago, who were the followers of a peculiar Frenchman called Louis Althusser. And they used to hold this view that you could talk endlessly and endlessly about history, but you never needed to actually know anything about the world. And so what you did was you kind of just talked and talked and talked about modes and structures and theses and antitheses and syntheses and tendencies and trends and so on. And if you actually sort of ever asked them, where is Europe in relation to Asia, they didn't know, because it was considered it was a bit unseemly to bring the world into history. And I don't take that view. And in fact, they went so far that they argued that you could argue something theoretically on the basis of theory without ever having to use facts. They are, what they called this was anti-empiricism. In other words, they said that bringing facts into history was to dirty the hands of the historian. And poor old Althusser was a victim of his own ideology in a very sad way, because like most people who hold such a peculiar theory, he went mad eventually. And what happened was that his wife was found strangled, and he tried to convince the police that he'd murdered his wife. And they told him that he wasn't there at the time when his wife was murdered. It's absolutely true. And he in fact argued that this was something which was he argued this was supposed to be the case, and there was a lengthy argument about that. But when you come to look at it, when you start trying to detach facts from the whole area of theory, and incidentally, this whole movement within history led to a great deal of depression and disillusion amongst the people who held it, because practically every one of the main people of the mid-1970s who were the leading advocates of this historical movement have all since ceased to function in any particularly significant way within the study of history. They've gone out of it, because it's a terribly disillusioning view of history when you simply wipe out all kinds of reference to what's actually going on.